Hello and welcome to the Texas Tribune Tribcast. I'm Andy Langer, and I assume I've been invited here today because this weekend is the Austin City Limits Music Festival, and I write about music for Esquire and the Tribune's Texas page in the New York Times. Or maybe it's a punishment. I've had an advance copy of the new Wilco album for 8 weeks or so, and Tribune CEO Evan Smith desperately wants to hear it. I refuse to make him a copy. Either way, it's a pleasure to say, welcome. Here's the Tribcast crew.
Thank you, Andy. This is reporter Reeve Hamilton with the Texas Tribune Tribcast. I'm joined by managing editor and ACL enthusiast, Ross Ramsey.
I feel like we all ought to talk like this.
I can't. I don't have an Andy Langer or a Jay Root radio voice.
Jay Root's radio voice. Here it is.
That's reporter Jay Root. I guess you already said hello.
Hello.
And reporter Brandy Grissom is also here.
Good morning.
And the four of us will be talking about Perry's last two debates and his first two debates and various issues that spin off of that. I guess maybe we should just dive in.
That was pessimistic. The last two debates? That's it?
Right. That's all. The first two. Well, Jay, how do you think they went?
Well, they were very newsworthy, don't you think? These were two of the best debates, really, that I've ever seen. Maybe it's because I'm more interested in Rick Perry as a presidential candidate than I would be normally in a presidential year, but they just were so rock'em sock'em, and they really mixed it up. I thought that they produced a lot of follow-up stories, a lot of really interesting news stories. For example, on the last debate, the whole HBV controversy and the follow-up about Mike Toomey, about Merck, all these donations, pay to play. Sarah Palin jumped in. So I'm pretty excited. These were really very substantial debates, I think.
Is newsworthy good or bad for Perry in this? I mean, as you said, it's bringing up lots of issues that he probably doesn't feel like he has a great need to revisit.
It's probably a little of both. I mean, you know, the campaigns right now are in the middle of, this is going to be the first month of fundraising, and they've got a fundraising reporting deadline, September 30th. So this is the first reporting thing period where they'll have Rick Perry in the mix. And to some extent, they're fighting the financial primary. So they're going to get to the end of September, and Perry's going to show a bunch of money, and Romney's going to show a bunch of money, and Bachman's going to show some money. And if you can knock somebody off the beam while they're talking in fundraisers and stuff, that's doubly beneficial because we all see it and it influences the news and everything. And it also might make the fundraisers give fundraisers some pause. I think one of the things the other candidates are afraid of is that Perry's going to come in strong on money and knock a couple of three people off the bottom of the ladder.
I think Perry is going to come in fairly strong on money. I mean, there's really no way to know until we see the reports. But and I also think that you're right that some of these news stories that come out of it can have the effect of sending a signal to donors. Ooh, wait a minute, like on this. And actually, I thought that when Mitt Romney, in some ways, surprisingly to me anyway, attacked Rick Perry from the left on this Social Security matter, I thought that was sort of a message that he was trying to get to donors. Hey, he's unelectable in the fall, so don't go with him now. And then, you know, then when this HPV controversy comes up, you know, I can't remember where I read it, but there was some story that said the elite, you know, Republican donors are still a little worried about Perry because they're afraid that maybe he'll explode or say something stupid or that there's something that's in his past that they didn't know about. So I think there is still a little bit of reluctance to really just tap into that mother load and be the cemented front runner. He hasn't quite grabbed a hold of the front runner thing and in a solid way and just held on to it yet.
You know, I think the other really fascinating thing about these last two debates has been how much of a role the audience has played in sparking debate and discussion afterward. In the first debate, when Governor Perry was responding to a question about the 234 executions that had happened up to that point under his leadership, you know, there was that uproarious applause, which caused some people some pause.
Well, even before he responded, they applauded the question.
No, it was just, it was just they applauded the sheer fact that many executions had happened on his watch in Texas.
Yeah, Woot, Texas. How about that?
So the response to that was strange and unusual.
Right,
and
Brian Williams, the moderator, was clearly taken aback by that.
Yeah, right. It was interesting to see his response. I thought that question, too, was interesting in that it didn't go any further than it did to ask Perry about some of the specific questions that have come up about executions under his leadership. I was sort of disappointed there wasn't more, you know, ask deeper questions on that issue.
Well, the first debate had a couple of things that were interesting about it. You know, everybody sort of hit him on HPV. This is the first place this came up. And Mike Toomey never got mentioned in the first debate. He never got mentioned, I don't think, in the afterburners, did he? I mean, it was sort of the second debate where the Toomey thing came up.
Right, and actually Toomey's name was not mentioned during the debate, his actual name, but it was like Perry's former chief of staff.
Right.
Well, I mean, someone in Wisconsin is not going to know who Mike Toomey is.
Maybe his sister lives in Wisconsin.
I mean, other than the Toomeys of Wisconsin.
Right, but yeah, no, I mean, I think that has really taken on a life of itself now, the whole Merck contributions. But back to what you said about the audience, Brandy, the audience reaction in the second debate, there was a reaction to the question was, I guess,
uninsurance, right?
Yeah, what would you say to somebody who needed insurance and who they were going to, I guess, cut off? And
no, it was somebody who opted out. It was a Ron Paul question. It was the whole thing about,
do you think people should
be able to opt out? And he said, yeah, this is a choice and blah blah blah. And he said, well, would you let him die? And
people shouted yes.
People shouted yes, and or somebody, I don't know if it was
there were two
but,
or three.
And there was sort of like an applause or whatever, and it's really fed this notion, too, that when Perry says he's taken aback by a Tea Party reaction, you have to think that the crowd has really gotten ahead of the politicians, and it's fed this notion of this pitchfork carrying sort of
like a pool of piranhas or something.
Yeah, just.
No, but that is
interesting. The mob doesn't quite get there.
If Perry is taken aback by it, you know, what does he view as his role in the creation of that environment where that sort of thing can happen in a public sphere?
I think they'd totally disavow that. I think, don't you?
Well, that reminds me of a moment one time where I'm not going to say who it was, but there was an aide to the governor who was like, oh, my God, these people are crazy. And I said, y'all are the ones who brought him to the party. I mean, it's kind of like, let's get him ginned up. And then they come and they start, your hair starts getting a little singed by it all. Then, this is the nature of the kind of group that we're talking about. I mean, they're very, very... riled up right now,
right.
And it's hard to really please them.
But it's, speaking of being hard to please, Perry did sort of help bring these folks in the Tea Party to the party,
right?
But they weren't always so favorable to him at the last debate. They didn't appreciate his responses on immigration. They gave him a hard time on HPV. There were even some boos.
They booed him on immigration too, didn't they?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's not always rosy.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting when Wolf Blitzer said, you got some boos there, Governor, which when has that happened? I mean, that's a little unusual. I think that Perry has been great at understanding what a plurality of the Republican primary is thinking. I mean, that's what he's been really good at. He's got one of the best political radar systems ever developed for figuring out what the largest chunk of Republican primary voters are concerned about. And he's done it again this year. But I think this is a challenging year because they say they want all of the, they want everything cut, but it's really hard to get ahead of them and please them, I think.
Did you see this skit last night on The Daily Show? One of the reporters was supposed to be at the debate, and he's naming off all these characters who would be completely unelectable to the Tea Party, and even like non-fictional characters like or fictional characters like Optimus Prime wouldn't even be acceptable.
Right.
I mean, it was just kind of funny.
And then they asked him about Ronald Reagan. He said, no way he'd get out of here.
Yeah.
It's interesting. We got to bring up this voice from the grave thing. It's really weird that the attack spot from Kay Hutchison that didn't show up in the governor's race now shows up, especially when you're in a Republican primary where...
Do you want to describe what that...
Yeah, I will. But, the setup for this is you're in a Republican primary where, at least in Texas, you go to a Romney event, and some of the people I know who've been to Romney fundraisers say it looks a little bit like a Kay Bailey Hutchison fundraiser. Here's Jim Francis over here, and here's Harlan Crow over here, and the people that were behind Kay against Rick. And then this Kay Bailey Hutchison HPV attack ad shows up. It's a little girl doing a nursery rhyme. The visuals are all of a playground, swing set, you know, merry-go-round. And it's a rhyme about Perry, HPV, the chief of staff, the campaign donations. It's the whole thing all in a bundle. I don't know why she never ran the spot. It was, you know, it looks like it might have been an effective attack spot. But in the context of all of this other stuff, it's like she's done a campaign contribution to everybody who's against Perry. It's amazing.
Can we assume that she didn't run the spot because they thought it might not play in Texas, but maybe we're seeing that it has more traction in the rest of the country?
Yeah, all campaigns cut a bunch of spots that they don't use. You know, they do their polling and they say, you know, we need to be talking about this today and not that, and you know, maybe you never get around to that. And she never really made a fist in that campaign and really threw a punch, I don't think.
You know, she ran some fairly harsh ads, but I couldn't help but look at that ad and think that would have been the most effective ad she would have been able to run. I mean,
more effective than her
cronyism stuff.
No, I was thinking more of her Trans Texas Corridor shots of the scenic highway ad.
Yeah, that looked like a travel poster. Those were weird.
I mean, that her ads were frankly not all that compelling, and they weren't the sort of take your head off ad. And I thought what was
this
really,
ad has like a horror movie trailer quality to it.
Yeah, it does. And the thing that it really does, and it's like it's haunting and a little bit. And you have this little girl, you know, and you hear the swing set, and it's very the text of it is very sneering. And mocking, sort of has a mocking tone to it, and I really think that might have been an effective ad.
Nightmare on Congress Avenue,
right?
Wes Craven.
Do you think if there wasn't this Merck connection with Mike Toomey to Perry, and Perry had still just gone ahead and done this sort of without that sort of cronyism element, which became more of a thing in the last debate, would this still be as big of an issue?
Yeah, I mean, you've got this Michelle Bachmann attack. There's a section of the Republican Party of conservatives. I won't put it in the party necessarily, but there are a bunch of people who don't like the idea of government-mandated vaccinations of any kind. You know, and they can go on and on and on and on about this stuff. And then you do this thing, and not only is it a government-mandated vaccination, but it involves girls, and it's a sexually transmitted disease, and you're talking about 12-year-old girls. It's just like, you know, how do you spell third rail? I mean, it's everything's there.
The reason why it's a direct hit, I had this sort of vision of like playing Battleship when you really get one of those direct hits on Battleship that Michelle Bachmann delivered.
It's the best feeling you'll ever have.
Well, the reason that it was is because it completely undermined one of Perry's central messages was get the government off your backs. And like this is the worst nightmare for a social conservative. It's like not only is this a government mandate, and it really was a mandate in the sense of any kind of mandate. Yes, you can opt out, but you're in unless you opt out. So most people are basically in the modern world, let's face it. But not only is it a government mandate, but it's, you know, giving you heard this phrase for the first time, government injection. She used that phrase. I'd never heard that phrase, and I thought that was a nice turn of phrase there. They've been thinking about that one. So this was directed, and I thought that Perry's answer about the $5,000 that, hey, you know, you're not going to sway me for $5,000. That's probably the worst answer I've ever heard him give. That was monumentally bad.
Really, Governor, how much does it cost?
I know. I mean, it was so obvious. It was kind of like, you know, come on. I mean, I coughed this up for breakfast. I mean, it just was not, that was not a good answer. And they know that. The campaign knows that. I mean, he that wasn't planned.
Ross
and it turned
I,
out to be $30,000, by the way, right?
$29,500.
Oh, yeah, that's how much he actually got from Merck. Ross and I are going to go. We're going to go see the government injections at ACL this weekend. It's going to be great.
It'll be a fantastic band.
Well, I was just wondering, because from a public health perspective, the way to get people vaccinated against, you know, any disease, if you mandate it and say, you know, you have to tie it to something like going to school, the vaccinations jump up incredibly, and then you have less transmission of a disease. I mean, that's how you counteract disease. Perry's position in the debates has been, well, you know, I'm for life, I'm against cancer.
The primary argument in public health for public vaccinations and for mandated vaccinations is against diseases that are transmittable, that are, you know, that are contagious. And this is transmittable, but only through sexual activity. It's not contagious. It's not a threat in the classroom. It's a different animal, and it doesn't have the same logic as most of the public health stuff.
It's not really a public health debate. It's a mandate government involvement debate. And
right.
So I don't know that the public health considerations, while they're certainly there, they're definitely a background issue to...
Well, and the other thing here is that the argument over HPV vaccinations is different now than it was when he proposed it. When he proposed it, there was only one approved drug. Doctors were mixed. You know, I had a daughter about that age, and the doctor was, I don't know, let me read some more about this. Doctors hadn't really, the medical community hadn't really landed. They've landed more now, but not completely. It was a different context. And it looked for, you know, I mean, it just looked like it had everything to do with the manufacturer. And it came out of the blue. I mean, it was like the kind of, the thing that was newsworthy about it at the time, you guys remember this, the thing that was newsworthy about it at the time was like, that's Rick Perry saying that? Really? I mean,
yeah,
I expected that from this one.
I remember when it happened, and I remember Jane Nelson in particular, Senator Jane Nelson,
she
just
really
losing
up.
Her mind. She was like, what? We're going to do what? I mean, it really seemed kind of shocking. In fact, Sarah Palin said on Fox the other day that when she saw Perry do this, she thought, geez, this doesn't seem right. And that's when she said she doubled down with the pay-to-play stuff and said, you know, when I found out that Merck was involved, then I understood this was a... you know, a cronyism type thing. So I think that added layer really gives it legs in a way that you wouldn't necessarily have. And I remember the day that Perry announced in Charleston, South Carolina, I was having dinner at a restaurant and talking to somebody who had seen his appearance later in New Hampshire when he began to walk away publicly from the decision on HPV. Because you remember, he went through all of 2010, insisting that he did the right thing. And so I took that as like a major news, and I think that's another reason why this has been, you know, a big deal, because it's recent that he changed his position. If he had changed his position in 2010 right. and said, I made a mistake then, I don't think it would be as big of a deal now. But he's just finding his sea legs on this new answer to this.
Right. Right. And you're right. I mean, it enforces it. It's 180 degrees off message. It's just, you know, bad juju.
Well, the other moment that we talked about from the debates was this death penalty moment. Where he actually was very solidly on two legs. I mean, he got applause before he answered and massive applause after he answered. He had a great answer on that. But I also wonder how much death penalty issues might follow him in the campaign, and that's why one of the reasons I had Brandy on this week.
And, to talk about death.
Yeah.
Like right. I do.
She's wearing black, ladies and gentlemen.
But I mean, there are, you know, there are, clearly from the applause, there are voters that sort of don't consider any executions particularly controversial if they've been found guilty in a court, and but there are some that others might take issue with, that I think a lot of them are sort of on the docket, right?
So, well, I mean, in the next couple of weeks alone, there are four scheduled. There was one last night. There's one scheduled for tomorrow night, and then there are two more this month that are scheduled to happen. And I mean, I think it's fair to say most death penalty cases are controversial just because of the extent of the punishment, the ultimate justice, as Governor Perry said. I mean, the execution that is scheduled to happen tomorrow night, one of the prosecutors in that case has come forward and asked Governor Perry to halt the execution because there were some questions brought up at this man's initial trial where the psychologist said that he would be a future danger to society because he was black.
Right.
And the same psychologist gave the same testimony in six other cases. Those other cases all had new trials, and in all of those cases, including the one that's set for execution this week, John Cornyn, who was Attorney General at the time, said, we messed up. We shouldn't have brought race into this. That makes this unconstitutional. All those other people who have had new trials, they have been sentenced to death, and all of them, except for one, I think, has been executed. But at least, you know, they had the chance to be to have a new trial
without
that element of race in it. And so, you know, that's the question that's going forward tomorrow night. Hank Skinner is on the docket for November, and the Supreme Court has called for at least consideration of testing DNA in his case that hasn't been tested. And he's on the docket to be executed, even though the courts have not resolved that question. So I think this issue of controversial death penalty cases certainly is not going to slow down at any time. And, well, arguably will only compound as the campaign continues.
We've talked about this a little bit before. I mean, you know, every Southern governor seems to go through this. There's the moment in the campaign where Bill Clinton has to talk about death penalty cases, where George Bush has to talk about, Jimmy Carter has to talk about.
I remember that one.
Perry said, I just had a romp through Perry's 6 State of the State speeches, and one of the State of the State things that he talked about back there somewhere was DNA evidence and how he wanted the legislature to make DNA evidence more prevalent and use it more in order to find cases where we had wrongly convicted somebody and in order to reassure ourselves of the guilt of people that we had convicted. So he was, you know, all for the DNA testing and all of that kind of stuff. His answer the other night, I mean, if you look at it, if you look at his answer through sort of the prism of a poll, Jim Henson came back and wrote a piece for us, our pollster, about this. You know, Perry's answer was spot on, and the internal logic of it is that, you know, if you say you are for the death penalty, and if you say you are prosecuting the death penalty, then the internal logic of that has to be because we have a fail-proof system, and I'm confident in the system. You know, if you're for it and you are executing people, then you have to profess some belief in the system, right? And, you know, somewhere along in there, you get this kind of friction where you say, well, wait a minute. If you trust the system, why don't you open this case? Why don't you open that case?
I do think there's a difference. But I talked to Jim about this after his piece ran. I think there's probably a difference between supporting something and sort of cheering something that he didn't address regarding the applause in that debate.
Right. Well, and the other question is there anybody else on that? Is there anybody else debating him or any of the other 7 candidates against the death penalty? Is anybody going to call him on this in the way that they call him on HPV or they call him on immigration?
I think probably not. And I think that's why, unless there is some evidence that something really terrible has, you know, happened, something that has gone awry with the implementation of the death penalty, that it probably won't be an issue, certainly in the primary and probably not in the general either. I don't think Barack Obama's going to bring it up. I mean, I just sense that most people still support the death penalty in this country, and it's like a loser issue for any candidate, any mainstream Democrat or Republican candidate, to have anything other than, you know, string him from the highest tree.
Well, and Kay Bailey Hutchison tried to bring up some of the Willingham stuff during her campaign and got absolutely nowhere with that.
It's a particularly difficult subject for a Republican candidate.
Right.
You're in a primary where they, you know, the Democrats in Texas support it too, but the Republicans really, really support it. It's just find something else to talk about.
How much does the buck stop with the governor on these things? I mean, because like the buck case that you... Well, that's an unfortunate.
Yeah, nice pun, Ray. Way to go. Smooth move.
But anyway, with the Buck case that you referenced, without a, you know, without a recommendation to revisit this, isn't he sort of limited in what he can do to stop it?
Sure. The way the Constitution spells out the power with the governor and the death penalty is the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles has to make a recommendation for clemency before Perry can grant the clemency. He does have authority on his own to grant a one-time 30-day reprieve, and that's something he can do without the Board of Pardons and Paroles. But the thing is, you have to also consider is that Perry has appointed all the members of the Board of Pardons and Paroles. And so certainly, to a large degree, they're not going to go... They're going to be people whose decisions align with his point of view. And if he had something to say about a case, certainly he would have their ear. So, you know, he doesn't have power to just do whatever he wants, but he probably has more power than it may appear.
He has some persuasive power. I mean, if he were to come out in any case, whatever the case was, and say, I'm going to give this 30 days, and I can't see why anybody on any Board of Pardons and Paroles would do this kind of thing without further investigation of X, Y, and Z.
Right.
I mean, that's a bully pulpit. He can, you know, he has some power here.
Right.
And he's an executive, and when you don't have power, if you're the governor, you're the one they point the finger at.
It's interesting, too, to go back and look and see how many times Perry has disagreed with the recommendations from the board. I mean, he has appointed all the members, and he's disagreed with their recommendations like something like 30% of the time.
Which direction does that disagreement usually go in?
Well, they, in the times that they've recommended clemency, I think there are three of them where he, in death penalty cases, where he said, no, I disagree, and we'll go ahead. And they don't grant clemency recommendations very often.
Well, anything else from the debates, Jay, that you notice that you think will be a lingering thing once this HPV issue is no longer the issue of the week?
Well, we didn't talk a whole lot about immigration, but I do think that immigration is going to come up again. I think that the Republican candidates think that they have room to hit Perry on this. I do think, though, that Perry will not change his answer. He's not going to throw the DREAM Act or whatever. I know that people don't like to call it the Texas DREAM Act, but the in-state tuition for certain illegal immigrants who meet a certain threshold. He's not going to throw that
it's
under the bus.
Such a catchy name.
Yeah. The campaign sees this as a good general election issue. This is where they would pivot if they were to win the nomination. And I think it would actually be pretty powerful. I mean, can you imagine, you know, Perry wins the nomination and all of a sudden he goes out and really campaigns right. for the Hispanic vote
right.
and says, you know what, I was, you know, some version of this. I was asked repeatedly to, you know, change my position on this. I was pressured, but I never did. I, you know, believe this is the right thing to do to give these children hope. And speaking of audience reaction, when Perry said during the debate, this bill proves that it doesn't matter where your last name is, that's when he got booed. So I think that he's taken on some slings and arrows for having what is, let's be honest, a very moderate position on immigration compared to the rest of this field. And is not going. I will be shocked if he changes his view on
well,
that.
And if you survive the field, you know, you go to a general election, and this plays in Texas, which doesn't matter. That's a Republican state. Plays in New Mexico, plays in Colorado, plays in California, plays in Nevada. I mean, that's a usable difference.
But do you think the in-state tuition bill is enough to overcome issues like voter ID and sanctuary cities and some of these other really controversial things that Perry has approved?
Look, he's not going to win a majority. I'll be shocked if he wins a majority of the Hispanic vote. He doesn't need to.
No, 30% would be.
If he wins 30% of it, you know, he's got something. It definitely gives him something. And it's not so much one issue. It's just how you frame it and how you talk about things. And he'll say, my brother-in-law is Hispanic, and, you know, I believe in the American dream, and these immigrants, yes, I've said some things that were controversial in my own party, and I stood up to my own party, right. because, you know, and I think we need to, I mean, it's powerful. It could be very, very powerful. If he could get the nomination, that's where he goes to the center, is on the Hispanic votes. And I think it would give him a much better shot at winning the presidency than if he didn't have that.
It's not just Hispanic votes, too. You know, you're going to have some number of independents in play here and some number of conservative Democrats in play here. And he can play to those crowds to some extent.
Right.
It's another thing where you just get a marginal difference, right?
It softens him, too. It's like the, you know, I remember when Bush was talking about the Hispanic vote, there was a lot of talk back then that, hey, this is really for the white soccer moms or whatever, just so they'll see that, hey, he's not this hardliner and a scary hardliner that, you know, is anti-people or whatever. And I think that that there's something to that, too, where it softens somebody who's got a very tough persona.
It's too bad that listeners can't see Jay pumping his fist as he stands up to his party.
They can hear it in his radio voice, though.
Yeah, that's right.
So going into these two debates, which was really sort of, in many ways, Rick Perry's sort of national debut for a lot of audiences.
Right.
He sort of came in as the front runner, or you could say co-front runner with Mitt Romney if you want to.
I think I'd say that.
And did anything happen in these debates that changed anyone's status at all?
Well, I mean, Perry solidified himself. And, you know, Bachman in the first debate, you know, got pushed underwater. I think she kind of made it back above the surface of the water in the second one. I think she fought her way back. She's still in this.
She fought her way back, but she has Rush Limbaugh saying that she's jumped the shark. And
yeah, but, you know, that's one vote. you know, Kane is inconsequential. Paul is, you know, there's always 6 or 7% that are going to be with Paul no matter what. I can't tell. I'm curious what you guys think. I can't tell whether Huntsman's getting anything here or not. You know, is this guy turning into a vice presidential candidate, or are we just watching a leaf wilt and fall off the tree here?
I think the latter. I wouldn't be surprised if Huntsman drops out soon. I think that Bachman is a walking dead person. She doesn't have any money. She's got a super PAC. I do think that she helped herself tremendously, and she could play a role in Iowa, but I don't see her being like a huge factor. I don't see her like coming back to life. She doesn't have the money. I mean, you got to have money. This was and ever shall be a two-person race until one of them wins between Romney and Perry. Romney's probably going to do better than Perry in the Northeast, and Perry will do better in the South, and their battleground's going to be the West, I think. And I think that these two debates have actually made this more competitive on a variety of issues. You know, I think Social Security in some ways helped Perry because it made him go, you know, it makes everybody else go defend a government program, which is not where you want to be right. in a Republican primary. Right. But on the other hand, it's probably raised some doubts about whether or not Perry, you know, can actually take this as a winning message in the fall. And then I think that, you know, Perry did not like go in and lose it in the debates. There were no knockout punches, but I think that he left some doubts about it was probably a little wobbly here and there. He, you know, some people use the phrase that I heard in the filing centers, you know, that he ran out of gas halfway through the debate. So I think that he held on to it. He held his own, but I think that the debates have shown what this is always was going to be in the beginning. It's a competitive race, but it's Mitt Romney and Rick Perry.
Do you think Gingrich could be angling for a vice presidential
position? He's a disaster. I mean, he's...
Well, I just think with this, I would say that his odd, let's all hang together against the moderators of the debate strategy is, I think Evan would say that's crap. I mean, it's just, it doesn't make any sense.
Starring Reeve Hamilton as Evan Smith. No, I don't think he has a chance, and I think, you know, he's got so much personal baggage. He's got all of everything that went wrong in Congress when he was there. He's, you know, no.
He's professorial and intellectual. He's an awful lot of fun to listen to, but everything is fundamental and profound. Have you ever noticed that about? It's like he uses the word fundamental and profound in almost every phrase, and after a while, I think he's not adapted to the Twitter, Facebook, 140 character world that we're in. He's I mean, it's unfortunate that a voice like that can't be part of it in a major way, but it's just it takes too long for him to get his soundbite out.
It's like that Orson Welles voice from the mountain on everything. It's just, you know, he's like, you're gonna vote for your history professor? It's just, you know, there's nothing really engaging about him. I mean, he's interesting, he's entertaining. But
maybe not profound enough.
Well, you just don't want, or fundamental enough.
Yeah. Well, let's turn this back over to Andy Langer for a second.
Hey, it's Andy Langer again. If you have questions or comments about the Tribcast, I'm not responsible. Instead, please email podcasts@texastribune.org.
Thank you. And that's it. Anyone have anything else to say? Good. On behalf of Ross, Jay, Brandy, our producer Todd, this is Reeve Hamilton. Thanks for listening.
You know, it's just like, this will tear up your whole body.